This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and good afternoon to you. I have sitting here across the table from me, WBUR legal analyst and retired federal judge Nancy Gertner. She's here to kick off the show because there is a lot going on in Massachusetts courts right now, from a rape case involving Worcester Polytechnic Institute to challenges at the Supreme Judicial Court to a proposed ballot question legalizing marijuana. So, Judge Gertner, it's great to have you back, and there's a lot to discuss.
Yes, great to be here.
Okay, so let's start at the SJC, because at the High Court, they heard oral arguments today in two cases that challenged that proposed ballot question on marijuana that could appear on the ballot in November. And the core issue here is whether or not the summary of the actual ballot question is misleading to voters. So here's some tape from oral argument today. This is attorney John Schecht arguing this morning on behalf of the ballot opponents.
The voters were significantly misled when they were told that this was going to legalize marijuana. It's going to do much more. And wouldn't a fundamental question of any voter be, what are you asking me to legalize?
So Schecht is basically claiming there that the summary language in the question is too broad. But Assistant Attorney General Robert Toone defended the Attorney General's summary of the ballot proposal and said that it is neutral and fair for voters.
There are many different ways marijuana can be ingested, and we couldn't possibly all contain them in a fair and concise summary. We have to use generalizations, and the term marijuana product captures all the different uses that will be.
So, Judge Gertner, this seems pretty technical, but history often turns on a technicality.
Right.
What's at stake here?
Well, it really is unbelievably technical. You know, the first let me sort of frame this. These questions are generally left to the discretion of the Attorney General. So the challengers, first of all, have an uphill battle. I mean, the summary matters because you're only asking voters yes or no. So a compound product or compound proposal would be difficult for a yes or no answer. And a summary that is misleading would be difficult for a yes or no answer. So a fair amount is at stake here in the sense that you want to make sure that when they say yes or no, that they know what they're talking about. But it's still very technical, and the odds are that a tie will go to the Attorney General's interpretation of this.
Hmm. Well, it seems, though, that the idea behind the idea of having summaries is to basically help voters understand what the initiative contains without having to put the entire language of the proposed law on the ballot. I mean, would that be a better option? I mean, that's not what the court is being asked to decide today, but it makes me wonder if by having to summarize legislative language, that there's always going to be some kind of challenge from people who don't like the idea of the law.
Well, the summary is on the ballot, but the voter also has accessible to him or her the actual initiative. So it really has both, but this is a way of sort of orienting people. This was sort of a consumer-friendly, a voter-friendly kind of thing, and the summary is at a level of abstraction. So instead of talking about the kinds of regulations they say would provide for the regulation of, if someone is concerned about regulation, they can dig more deeply to see what it comprises here. So every summary is at a level of abstraction and simplifies to some degree. And the question here, I suppose, is whether the simplification here went too far and didn't convey the nuances of the underlying proposal.
Hmm. If you were on the bench right now, I mean, what questions would you be asking to help answer that fundamental question?
Well, I mean, it seems to me you might want to think about other ways of having said it mm-hmm. without, in other words, one of the things that the Attorney General was saying is that in order to be more specific would have required an enormous amount of detail. In other words, that there's nothing in between this level of generality and the initiative itself. And I would have to think about that, whether or not you really would have to go, for example, regulation with respect to, mm-hmm. and whether that makes any sense.
Okay. Well, the SJC will likely have to decide on this case before the 6th of July, and that's when ballot supporters would have to file additional voter signatures to ensure that the question gets placed on the November ballot. So we'll see what happens as the summer progresses. But Judge Gertner, let's turn to another case that's currently going on. It's quite a complicated one. It's a lawsuit against Worcester Polytechnic Institute brought by a student who was raped in a university university leased building in Puerto Rico in 2012. Now, the person who did attack her was convicted. He was a security guard who worked in the building. He was convicted and is serving a 20-year sentence. But the student is also claiming that the university did not properly vet the security guard and is alleging that they were that WPI was negligent. I'm not sure if I've ever seen a case like this. And what's your first
take? There have been many cases involving colleges and universities. I litigated them before I became a judge. Colleges, universities, about their obligation to keep students safe. You know, what kind of locks were on the doors, what kinds of triage about guests coming into the building. So there have been their premises liabilities cases. That's what they're called.
But in this case, I mean, I think the thing that's getting a lot of people's attention is that Worcester Polytechnic's attorneys are countering that the victim was partially responsible. I mean, the Globe has been reporting that those attorneys are saying that the student ignored information and training, that she drank excessively that night, followed the security guard, did things that were unadvised by Worcester Polytechnic. Now, the president of WPI, Lori Leshin, said in an email that, quote, WPI has never and would never blame a victim for being raped and strongly believes that the person responsible for the rape is the rapist and he is in prison. But nevertheless, the institute's attorneys are making this counterargument.
Well, let's back off for a second. So if there was a case about whether or not there were locks on the doors and the school had not adequately provided locks on the doors, but an individual, and they did provide locks on the doors, but an individual left the door open, then the defense would be what's called contributory negligence, which would say, we did everything we could to make it safe, and you have kept the door open.
But this now, is a case
rape
of behavior.
Right.
Yeah.
This is different, and certainly some of what is being alleged about drinking, et cetera, arguably the university has an obligation to keep drunk students safe as well. So you can't use that. But I think there actually is a question here. And the question is, does she go with the security guard because she's been led to believe that the security guard was a trusted person who had been vetted by the university, or did she go with the security guard under circumstances when no one could have believed that it was legitimate? The questions about drinking, all of that, I agree, are absurd and really hark back to an old-fashioned and repudiated view about women. But certainly there's a question about in what respect was what the circumstances were. She claims that she went where she went because she assumed that this was a trusted man who the university had vetted when he invited her up.
Is that not a fair assumption? I mean, the person was hired as a security guard.
Right, but the security guard could be asking you to do something preposterous. I think the facts have to be examined. In other words, what I'm saying here is the concept of contributory negligence allows you to look at what the victim of any negligent act did, right? But how far you go is really the issue here. Talking about what she was wearing and going out drinking is really old-fashioned and inappropriate. Talking about the circumstances under which this happened is not inappropriate. The question is what the content of that discussion is.
Now, how, I mean, you've said that you have actually been involved in prior cases that had to deal with negligence of a similar sort. I mean, how much of an impact do these cases have on colleges and universities? Because this question of where the institution's responsibility to the student begins and ends has got to be we know it's a pressing one and a constant one. And there's always this tension because, I mean, the students are under the care and purview of the university. But then again, technically, most of them are adults, right? 18 and older. So, you know, if you're a college or university, how are you looking upon this case?
Well, these kinds of cases really created an obligation on premises and premises just in general, but universities in particular, to do all sorts of things to protect students. There's no question. There's been a body of law that's been developing over 30 years. And typically it had to do with security measures. You know, it was the guy who broke into the dorm because the windows couldn't lock or because the gate wasn't locked. And that's the easy part. But you're raising a much more difficult problem, which is how far do you go? So let's say you have a security guard here whom you did not appropriately vet. Let's say you had people in the building and you didn't actually train them about, this is now taking place in Puerto Rico, you didn't give them any warnings about what being in, not a, what being in, it's within the United States, but you didn't give them warnings about what the environment would be like. How far do you go? Do you have, what kind of your obligation to protect students? And the answer is within the four corners of that building, pretty far, pretty far. But when you start talking about behavior, as you suggested, what's the point at which you have warned enough and trained enough and the student then is responsible for her own behavior? Not, I might add, responsible in the rape criminal case.
Right.
None of this is relevant to whether the man who raped her should get the punishment that he did or should be prosecuted. The issue is how much does the student, does the university have an obligation or the college have an obligation to protect? And that's why I'm saying that there is, in fact, there's a question here. We may figure out the answer to the question, but there's a question here, which is what were the circumstances under which she went to the roof?
Right.
Does she go to the roof because he was in a uniform and trusted in some way? Does she go to the roof because she really, who knows why she went to the roof for some other reason? And it wouldn't have mattered whether he was trusted. Clearly, the fact that he was an authorized person of the college contributed to her going following him.
I'd also say that there's, you know, there's various different people may have different levels of what they consider a appropriate amount of self-protection and trust as well. But obviously, this is an ongoing
but,
case.
Yeah, we'll but keep, I do we'll want to separate out. But the drinking and the, you know, how she was dressed and all that stuff is really out of this discussion.
Right.
It's the circumstances under which she accepted his invitation, and that's a different question.
So this case is ongoing, and we'll talk about it more as
ongoing. But in the light of this controversy, I would bet it'll be settled very quickly.
Well, we'll see what happens. Because there are a couple, two other quick things I really want to talk with you about, and one of them is. The fact, I just want to get, I mean, given the fact that you sat on a federal bench for so many years, I have to ask you what you make of what Donald Trump has said about another member of the federal judiciary, questioning his ability to be an impartial judge simply based on his, you know, his ethnic origin.
It's an outrageous comment. It is an outrageous comment. Just at a time when we've spent the past two or three decades increasing the diversity of the bench. I'm a product of part of those efforts, making sure that the bench was not male and white and older and reflected the diversity of our communities. And we did this because a bench that reflects all of us is a more legitimate institution than one that looks like white males of a certain age. And what he has done, what he has said, completely undermines it. Just because we want diversity on the bench doesn't mean that all of us are reduced to our gender, our ethnicity, or our background. In other words, we want different people on the bench so that we understand that government, that power, state power, can be exercised by all its people, by everyone, no matter where they come from. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you're reduced to that. Women didn't automatically win in my courtroom. Hispanics don't automatically win in his courtroom. We understand that this is, everything is filtered by the job of being a judge. All of the experiences that we have are filtered by the profession. And he doesn't give you, there is no concrete reason to say anything about this judge except that he was losing in front of it. If that's a rationale for disqualifying a judge, then every disgruntled litigant has a case.
Well, I wonder if we're going to start seeing more of that. I mean, which would be a shame. But in a statement just yesterday, Donald Trump said, quote, "It's unfortunate that my comments have been misconstrued as a categorical attack, against people of Mexican heritage." He says, "I do not feel that one's heritage makes them incapable of being impartial. He just feels justified in questioning whether he's receiving a fair trial based on rulings that they've received in the Trump University civil case."
It was available to Trump to challenge the judge for bias. It was available to his lawyers to do. In fact, his lawyer was interviewed on television and said, "We had no basis to challenge this judge for bias." So it's clear that the only reason he is making this challenge is because the judge's parents were Mexicans. And that is really outrageous, doesn't begin to summarize what that means.
Do you think it's dangerous for how the American people see the impartiality of the bench.
Absolutely. It's tremendously dangerous. One of the things about the bench, which I felt very acutely when I was a judge, is that, you know, you have no army. Your ability to influence behavior depends upon the legitimacy of what you do, depends upon the respect to which the institution respect it's afforded. What he does with these comments is to begin to rip into that respect and that legitimacy, and it's really an outrage.
Yeah. Well, my producers are getting mad at me that we've gone so far over time, Judge Gertner, but I can't help it. Nancy Gertner is WBUR's legal analyst. She's a retired federal judge and currently a professor at Harvard Law School. She walks us through major legal issues of the week here at WBUR. Judge Gertner, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.